Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi and welcome. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Today we'll be talking with Amelia Zivotofskaya, a leading voice in the world of positive psychology. Amelia is a widely sought-after speaker, educator, facilitator, and coach. She obtained her master's degree in applied positive psychology from the University of Pennsylvania, guided by the founder of this field, Professor Martin Seligman. She went on to design her certification in positive psychology and became the founder of the Flourishing Center, a New York City-based benefit corporation, which is dedicated to increasing the flourishing of individuals, organizations, and communities worldwide. Amelia is currently pursuing her PhD in mind-body medicine at Saybrook University, where she is also on the graduate faculty. So, welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Tell me about positive psychology. What is it? Where do you find it? And how has it become an actual profession?
Positive psychology is defined as the scientific study of optimal human functioning. And the textbook definition says it aims to promote and discover the factors that enable individuals and communities and organizations to thrive. It was started in 1998 by Dr. Martin Seligman, and it was based on the premise that psychology, as a scientific study, had been a half-baked field, meaning it spent a lot of time and a lot of energy studying how do we prevent and how do we fix things that are wrong in people's lives or wrong with people, and it didn't really know much from a scientific perspective how to build what's right with people. So there are many places where you can find positive psychology today. Most of it happens through scholarly research and through publications. There are a few courses that you can take, many videos you can watch on YouTube, and it really is spreading like wildfire because people love the bridge between the types of topics you might find in a self-help book or on Oprah and the research science that's being conducted in actually testing interventions that can help people, dissecting concepts that are useful for people to understand to get mind and body mastery over themselves. And a lot of great research is coming out in this field. So it's a very, very exciting time for myself and for my colleagues and for people who desire to lead a life of well-being and happiness and fulfillment, because we actually now have tested methods for achieving that.
Tell me a little bit about your own journey and how come this field attracted you.
My journey in this field started way before I even knew the field existed. I, on a personal level, had overcome a number of tragedies in my life, and during the time, I never really thought of them as something I was overcoming or any big tragedies. It was just living my life and doing my life. And I remember one of the things was that at the age of 14, my brother passed away through an accident. And I remember that moment in time thinking I had a choice to make. I could either become really bitter and resentful that this is the trajectory that my family's life had to go in, or I was going to somehow use it to be a better person and to carry my brother's memory forward. And I remember making that decision. And throughout my life, people would tell me, oh, you're so resilient and look at all the things you've overcome. And I was really curious about whether or not resilience was just this thing that I had figured out, or if it's somehow something that can be taught and translated to people and can be given to others. So I became really interested in that, and was one of the reasons that I went on to pursue my master's degree in positive psychology. And also, I had been a professional party entertainer for about 12 years. I spent entertaining people's bar mitzvahs and weddings and block parties, and I had a career that was based on joy and ritual and play. And I loved my work, and I loved that I could come into people's lives for short periods of time and bring enthusiasm and energy and happiness. And I wanted to find a way not just to make people happy for a few hours at a time, but how can I help people create lasting happiness in their life? And so I studied traditional psychology, though I was passionate about psychology and the study of the mind and the study of the body. I wasn't as excited about the type of topics I was covering. I wasn't as excited about diagnosing mental illness or understanding what was wrong. I really wanted just to help your everyday person. So when I found out that the field existed, that it was taking the science and the research that I was so passionate about and applying it to the types of questions I was asking. How can we leverage our strengths? How can people identify their passion and their purpose in life and pursue that? And how do we take our relationships to make them even better? Asking all these questions that I naturally wanted to work on in my own life that I was helping other people do. And it was giving me answers to those. So it was a great way to not just help people be happy for an hour or a few hours, but to pursue lasting happiness and to really understand that and help people do that thing and to help them be more resilient.
Tell me a little bit about the program itself. How does it work? If you come out with a certificate, are you capable and able of being a counselor? Tell me about the program.
I started in the field of positive psychology in 2006. Graduated in 2007 with a master's degree in positive psychology, which at the time was only one of two master's degrees in the whole U.S. in the field of positive psychology. So there was very little by way of formal education or training. A lot of people who were in this field were self-taught, getting by at books and academic conferences. And in 2008, I started the Flourishing Center and started to teach topics in positive psychology, which I found that particularly people who were practitioners, people who worked with people, whether it be teachers, educators, coaches, therapists, trainers, mentors, all of these people who interacted with people loved positive psychology because it gave them tools that they can continue to use with their people that they interacted with, managers, HR professionals, you name it. So after creating multiple workshops and courses in positive psychology, I put them together into a certification in applied positive psychology. So the program was born in 2012, and it's now offered in 12 cities across the U.S. and Canada. And what the program prepares you for is it's not a master's degree in psychology, nor is it a PhD in psychology or counseling or anything clinical. In order to call yourself a psychologist in the United States, you need a doctorate, whether it be a PsyD or a PhD in psychology. And positive psychology is a scientific study. It doesn't do anything clinical by way of diagnosing people, doesn't diagnose mental illness. It just offers us tools for your everyday person to be happier and healthier. So getting certified in positive psychology enables you to, in many ways, do the same thing that one would do with a master's in positive psychology, or if someone were to get a degree in social psychology or evolutionary psychology or cognitive psychology. These are all theoretical studies, and it's up to the person to figure out how they would apply it. Some natural career paths that many of my graduates have turned to and that we prepare you for are things like coaching or speaking and teaching and training or integrating positive psychology into what you traditionally do. For example, there are people who are trained in traditional psychology as therapists or clinicians or mental health counselors and social workers who are trained on the clinical side of it, and what they do is integrate positive psychology into what they used to do. So they might become a positive psychotherapist where they used to be a traditional psychotherapist. We've had people who are physical therapists who have started to integrate positive psychology theories into their practice, so they'll call themselves a positive psychology-based physical therapist. Coaching is another really great career path for people who are interested in the topics that positive psychology offers and are interested in working with people on a one-on-one basis or in a group basis that has to do with helping people meet their goals. So one of the best analogies that we give is that therapy is to traditional psychology as positive psychology is to coaching. So therapy would be really good for all of the types of things that traditional psychology offers us, things like diagnosing illness, understanding why people are stuck, understanding the origins of disease and what's disabling a person, and how to help them get rid of it. And traditional psychology was trying to get a person from the negative back to neutral or baseline. And positive psychology is all about getting a person from baseline to positive states, like plus one or plus 10, as opposed to just trying to get them from negative two back to zero or from negative 10 back to zero. And coaching is a great modality for that, because coaching is all about helping people who might not have anything clinically wrong with them. They're just wanting to build more happiness and more satisfaction with their life into their everyday experiences. They want to set goals and achieve them. They want better quality relationships. They want more meaning in their work. They want to have a body that they love. They want to make things happen. And so positive psychology becomes a great complement to it. So we say coaching is the best application of positive psych, and we say that positive psychology is what gives the whole coaching industry backbone, because it's science-based and it's rigorous, and the evidence-based practices are some of the big buzzwords in the field of coaching today that people are using. When you're working the well-being model, meaning you're not just trying to get rid of disease or to prevent disease, you're trying to help a person build well-being, they need to learn skills in order to be able to do that. And so learning how their mind works, how their body works, what do they need, how to work with their emotions, how to build better relationships, how to communicate better, how to do all of these things are things that are taught and can be taught to people. And so giving workshops, podcasts, writing, blogging, courses, all of these types of careers and streams of income are things that we help our students create. Because it is just the science of well-being, really you could do anything with it, just not call yourself a psychologist, which also is the same thing for a master's degree in positive psychology.
You keep using the word science, so can we break it down to get a little evidence of how this might work?
The measurement tools that are offered in positive psychology are really varied depending on what you want to study. Again, positive psychology is anything having to do with being north of neutral. So we have different reliable and valid measures for everything from people's signature strengths to subjective levels of happiness, to how do we measure how much meaning a person has in life, to how they rate their relationships. So the thing that makes positive psychology a science, and we call it a science because it's not prescribing what people should do. As a science, it describes. And the two main differences in studies come from either correlational studies or experimental research. Correlational studies is when scientists will study a sample of people and want to understand how certain things correlate or with one another. So they might study the correlation between adolescents with the signature strength of curiosity and their test scores at the end of the year. Or they might study the correlation between marital satisfaction and happiness levels in general. Or sometimes positive psychology recently has been combining biology with subjective experiences. So they might say, what's the relationship between scoring high on an optimism test and having had any incidence of cardiovascular disease? All of these are correlational studies that come from the field of positive psychology. And every once in a while from those correlational studies, we're even able to find some causation studies or causal research, which is actually able to show that not only do some of these things pair together in life, but they actually are caused, meaning we actually now have some research that shows that having high positive emotion is actually a cause of different elements of succeeding in life, such as having more thriving relationships, and particularly when it comes to work, actually succeeding more at work. The people who are more that score high on things like happiness and positivity would be more likely to succeed than people who are scoring higher on things like anger or negativity and worry. So we call it a science because it uses the scientific method of testing, of controlling, of measuring, of observing these things in nature, in laboratories, in the field, and using that to inform theories and practices and interventions.
So would you ever give me particular methods for incorporating positive psychology, or would the study give me more insight and an inkling into how to make my own personal changes, for example?
Well, you say that positive psychology as a science is a descriptive method, meaning we're describing what works. We're not necessarily prescribing, meaning I'm not going to say, oh, you know, you need more forgiveness in your life. Are you right there? You need more meaning. That's what's really going to make you happy. Traditionally, just the science informs us about how these things work, how it affects people in studies, and lets you make up your own mind in terms of what's the best way of doing it. When we talk about the application of positive psychology, such as working with a coach or working with a teacher or with a mentor, you might get some prescriptive, meaning when I work with my coaching clients and I'm seeing that there's a lot of social comparison going on. My client is spending a lot of time thinking about how her work is compared to other people's work, and it's actually stopping her from just doing the things that she's really passionate about doing and sharing. I might actually share with her some of the research that shows that social comparison, whether you're looking at what other people have that you don't have or what you have that they don't have, is actually not so helpful. A better example is, I just used this a few days ago with one of my coaching clients who she would report herself as someone who's a high-level worrier. And there's a tremendous amount of evidence in the field of positive psychology that separates problem solving from the emotion of worry. And if you think about it, why do we worry? We worry because we want to prevent something bad from happening in the future. And we think that if we worry about it, we can prevent this bad thing from happening. And what the research shows is that they're two very separate things, that the emotion of worry and actually problem solving when something bad might happen are two completely different things. And in fact, high-level worriers don't problem solve as well as people who aren't scoring high on levels of worry, because worry and stress actually put you into a negative emotional space where you're less likely to be able to access solutions and things that you can do about the situation.
Sure.
You're more likely to just be in a stress space. So when I explained this to her and I said that, hey, we can get you problem solving, but you don't need to hold on to the negative emotion, she said, wow, that gives me the permission to stop worrying. Of course I want to problem solve this. Of course I want to be able to just do something about it. And she thought that she wouldn't be able to unless she was worrying about it. So that would be a great example where I share research with my clients to help them understand themselves better, to help them understand the situation better. I can sometimes offer things that are helpful. Positive psychology offers us a lot of different tools for how to work with our emotions, how to work with mind chatter, how to boost our own positivity, how to work better, to have more flow, more engagement. It gives us lots and lots of tools. In some ways, I would say it gives us too many tools. That's why the certification program that I run is a 200-hour program, and people ask me, well, can I just learn everything by reading a book? Isn't there one book on it? Or can this just be taught in a one-weekend workshop? And there's just too many tools. But the more tools you have, the more mastery you can have over your life.
Sure.
And we need different tools for different situations. And so the mastery of the practitioner is how to put all of the tools together.
We're speaking today with Emilia Zhivodovskaya about the power of a need for pursuit of positive psychology. She is the founder of the Flourishing Center in New York City. Is there a difference between positive psychology and something like happiness, for example?
Well, happiness is a subjective state, and positive psychology is the field of study that looks at everything from happiness as a subjective state to things like well-being and life satisfaction and flourishing. So when you say, is there a difference between happiness and positive psychology, we used to say that positive psychology was the scientific study of happiness. Now we say it's the scientific study of flourishing, meaning flourishing includes happiness. And so happiness can be described as a subjective moment by moment of experience, meaning someone comes and they give you a big hug and they tell you they love you and you just go, wow, I'm so happy. Or something good happens and you say, I'm so happy. Versus positive emotions and what we call an affective state. Happiness is your affective state, which is that the background music of your life has a tone of positivity versus being really satisfied with your life and life satisfaction, which is kind of zooming out even more. And life satisfaction is when we say, all things considered, my life is really good. I'm satisfied with my life. So happiness is just one part of positive psychology, and we have different ways of measuring happiness, different ways of understanding it, looking at measuring happiness on an individual level, an organizational level, on a societal level. But in many ways, positive psychology is about so much more than just happiness.
And what happens to people who may have chemical or genetic imbalances and require meds or more strident therapies? How would you interweave positive psychology into their framework?
There's a great amount of research that informs us that people can still thrive with mental illness. People can flourish in their lives and have a diagnosis, whether it be bipolar disorder or have had episodes of depression or mania or something like borderline personality disorder. And we know that the disorder itself is not necessarily the problem as it relates to people's well-being. It's how do they work with that? So when we look at something like genetics, research shows that the differences between people's happiness levels does have an element of biology involved in it, that about 40 to 50% of the difference between people's happiness is attributed to that. So if I were to say on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you? And you would rate that, let's say you give yourself a number, and then I were to rate myself on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy am I? And I would give myself a number. The difference between why I give myself the number that I do and you give yourself the number that you do, about half of that is about genetics and how your body is wired versus how my body is wired. About 10% of the differences have to do with situational differences, where you were raised versus where I was raised, our differences in our education level, our age, our income, or any of the events of our lives. And then about 40% of it is what we call intentional, meaning what you think, what you feel, and what you do, how I think, how I feel, and what I do. And about 40% of the differences between people's happiness is about that. This is why when people say, well, just be happy, or just think happy, or just feel better, is only less than half of the pie. It's not enough to just say that.
Sure.
However, it is still very, very early on in us understanding the biology of happiness. We know that there are many, many chemicals that go into our life experience and many different things that go into the genetics of it. There is some research that shows that if you have a shorter gene related to the production of transporting serotonin, the 5-HTTLPR gene, if you have a shorter version of it, you may be more susceptible to depression, whereas if you have a long version of that gene, it might be linked to life satisfaction. But we're not at the state where we're actually measuring those type of things from people. We're not at that state where people are able to really get a measure of serotonin in their body. And it really varies person to person. There's so many things that affect the biology of our body, from your nutrition to how much activity you get. One of the best reasons why exercise boosts our immune system and boosts our mood the way that it does is because exercise and physical activity create something in our body, in our brain in particular, called BDNF. And the more BDNF we have present, the more serotonin gets released in our body. So exercise helps us feel good for many reasons, one of which is it actually helps create more serotonin. We also know serotonin is created in the gut. And so our nutrition plays a big factor to how we feel. So what we say for people who are suffering from depression or anxiety or have a clinical diagnosis is that at the end of the day, they can still thrive. And research shows that positive psychotherapy or traditional psychotherapy that integrates positive psychology and interventions such as gratitude and hope and strength and forgiveness and all of these other skills that we teach helps people who are struggling more than traditional psychotherapy and traditional psychotherapy, even with medication added to it, that positive psychology can be helpful to them. The other challenge, though, I will say, though, is that when people's positive emotions are lower, they sometimes tend not to benefit from intervention as much as someone who already has a fairly high baseline level of happiness and well-being.
Sure.
So there are some interesting factors that we want to keep in mind, but one of the most important things is for people to identify their own set point level of happiness. And many people expect that maybe that major life events should change their happiness level significantly, either a lot happier or a lot less happy. And what the research shows is that people do tend to have a set range that they dance in their well-being, and that the only real proven way to measurably increase our happiness level is not through major life changes, but through small day-to-day impacts to our habits. And that takes time. It takes time to be able to make those kind of shifts and changes.
So we're running out of time, but I do have a two-part final question. In founding the Flourishing Center in New York City, very briefly, what was your vision and hope for the people who would come to you? And then with that in mind, what is your final tip for the listener?
Wow, what a question. Thank you for asking. Why? My vision for the Flourishing Center is that people would learn that flourishing is not as hard, not as far off as we think that it is, and it's actually a teachable skill set that can be practiced. So my vision was to bring people together who are passionate about well-being and passionate about making the world a better place, and recognize that it starts with an internal process, doing this for themselves, and as they learn how to do this for themselves, they can help other people do it too. So that was my vision, and it continues to expand, and I'm humbled that we have hundreds of students who have gone through the program that are part of this mission and vision to make the world a better place. And my tip for the listeners is to recognize that there are so many tools out there, and the tools keep pointing in a very similar direction, one of which is prioritizing positivity and really making an actual effort to add positive emotions into their day-to-day experiences. And that can be done in a real simple way, just by starting to savor what we have. And oftentimes people don't want to let themselves feel happy until they get the new job, until they get their bills paid off. It's like, how can I be happy when I have these things happening? And it's not an either or. Either I'm happy or these things are working out. It's that we're wired to, over time, adapt to the people and to the circumstances of our lives. It's one of the things that we've evolved for. It's made us very resilient as a human species. And when we can begin to remember that we can savor the very simple things in life, a great cup of coffee, a conversation with someone that we care about, the opportunity to be of service to people, to enjoying the sunset, that we can induce our own positivity, and we can become our own chemical factory. We can produce those positive emotions when we feel connected to people, when we feel like we're doing good in the world.
We've been speaking with Amelia Zhivotofskaya about the power of, need for, and pursuit of positive psychology. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
For more information on the Certificate in Positive Psychology program, go to certificateinpositivepsychology.com. To contact Amelia directly, www.emilia.com. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. I want to thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, I hope you take care.